Welcome to the Unheard Daily Podcast. The article you're about to listen to is narrated by the team over at NOAA and is taken from today's Unheard edition. You can read other great articles as well as listen to and watch more Unheard content over at unheard.com or via the Unheard app.
For NOAA, this is Humanism is Heresy, written for Unheard by Tom Holland on the 26th of November.
There is nothing particular about man. He is but a part of this world. This observation on the pretensions of humanity, cool, disillusioned, unsparing of sentimentality, was made in the 40s, midway between our own time and the publication of The Origin of Species. Darwin did not, in his foundational work on evolution, focus on Homo sapiens. Only with the publication 12 years later of The Descent of Man did explicitly address the question of whether man, like every other species, is descended from some pre-existing form. Nevertheless, the implications of his theory, of humanity's claim to a special status, had been evident enough from the start. Bishops might mock and demand to know whether Darwin's followers were descended from gorillas on the father's side or the mother's side, but humans ranked, in the final reckoning, as organisms just like any other. For them to imagine otherwise, to regard themselves as somehow superior to the rest of creation, was a conceit verging on the ludicrous. Darwin was not, of course, the first to have undermined the notion that humans might stand at the centre of the universe. In 1638, the young John Milton in Florence visited the famous Galileo grown old, a prisoner to the Inquisition, for thinking in astronomy otherwise than the Franciscan and Dominican licenses thought. It was not the sun that revolved around the earth, so Galileo had taught, but the earth that revolved around the sun. Time came to prove his hypothesis right. Today we know that the sun is an undistinctive star in an undistinctive corner of an undistinctive galaxy, in a universe so stupefyingly vast that it can hurt the brain even to try and comprehend its size. Set against the icy immensities of space, what is humanity then but the merest speck of a speck of dust? What scope is left us as a species to claim any dignity at all? In science, as the astronomer Seth Shostak has put it, if you think you're special, you probably aren't. Strikingly, however, in an age that has seen the theory of evolution almost universally accepted in Britain, and the limits of our knowledge of the universe pushed to ever more credible extremes, there seems to have been no diminution in the value that we, as a culture, ascribe to human life. Quite the contrary. That we are all of us possessed of a certain fundamental rights, simply by virtue of being human, and of a dignity that embraces our entire species, are doctrines so widely accepted in contemporary Britain that many of us barely recognise them as doctrines at all. It is a measure of just how radically these beliefs privilege human beings that they have increasingly come to be described, over the course of the past century, as humanist. The term is a vague one, and the fuzziness of the definition has encouraged various attempts to endow it with a greater precision. In 2002, the World Humanist Congress, meeting in the Netherlands, issued what its delegates presented as the official defining statement of world humanism. The Amsterdam Declaration proclaimed the worth, dignity, and autonomy of the individual and the right of every human being to the greatest possible freedom compatible with the rights of others. Religions, dismissed as dogmatic, were condemned for their ambition to impose their world view on all of humanity. Science and its methods, by contrast, were highly praised. Not for humanists any Bronze Age mumbo-jumbo. Ethics were to be derived, not from skyfarers, but through a continuing process of observation, evaluation, and revision. To accept the truth of all these various propositions, one might almost call them dogmas, requires, of course, less the exercise of reason than a leap of faith. That science sustains a belief in human rights is hardly an obvious proposition. Implausible, too, is the conviction of those who issued the Amsterdam Declaration that their own values are where, a continuing process of observation, evaluation, and revision is bound to lead, so much so that they rank, in effect, as universal. International the humanists may claim to be, but in truth they are preponderantly Western. The delegates who met in Amsterdam for the first World Humanist Congress came from the Netherlands, the United States, Britain, and Austria. Only one of the 18 subsequent congresses have been held outside Europe, North America, or Australasia. The headquarters of Humanists International is in London. Its understanding of universal is, then, a somewhat culturally contingent one. Humanists, unsurprisingly, tend to reject this characterization. They prefer to see themselves as the heirs of traditions of intellectual inquiry that embrace the globe and reach back millennia. In ancient India, in Confucian China, in classical Greece, writings have been identified by humanists that appear to prefigure the very things that they themselves believe. Yet the risk of this approach is not merely that it results in cherry-picking, but that it can obscure the very alien quality of those texts which are being cherry-picked. Take, for instance, ancient Greece, the civilization for which humanists have long had a particular fondness. Epicurus, for all that he featured in a list of famous atheists drawn up by the philosopher Sextus Empiricus, believed in gods. The only value of research into the natural world, so Epicurus believed, was to enable the philosopher, by properly appreciating the pointlessness of superstition, to attain the state of tranquillity that was, so he taught his disciples, the ultimate goal of life. The closest modern parallel is less Richard Dawkins than the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. To draw on a fittingly Darwinian analogy, ancient atheists and modern humanists resemble one another in the way pterosaurs resemble bats, as examples of similar features developing in unrelated species. The isolated prefigurings of humanist beliefs that are to be found scattered in ancient texts does not in itself demonstrate an evolutionary relationship between them. But how common, in antiquity, are the fundamental tenets of humanism? That humans, no matter their sex, their place of origin, their class, are all of equal value, and that those who walk in darkness must be brought into light. Not common at all, I would say. Indeed, I would go so far as to say that their fusion was pretty much a one-off. There is no single text, perhaps, that is more consistently the object of humanist contempt than the book of Genesis. The creation of the cosmos in 6 days, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, Noah's flood. Here are stories that have long served as prime exhibits in the contention that religion is merely a farrago of childish nonsense. This is why Genesis can pretty much be guaranteed not to feature in roundups of the ancient texts that humanists are prepared to acknowledge as influences. Yet humanists, no less than Jews or Christians, are indelibly stamped by it. In fact, if there is a single wellspring for the reverence they display towards their own species, it is the opening chapter of the Bible. Gods in antiquity were not in the habit of endowing humanity with an inherent dignity. Quite the opposite. I will make man, who shall inhabit the world, that the service of the gods may be established and their shrines built. So spoke Marduk, who, according to the Babylonians, created humanity out of a sticky compound of dust and blood, to be the slaves of deities. Here was an understanding of man's purpose, bleak and despairing, that it would have been very easy for the exiles brought to the banks of the Euphrates from sacked Jerusalem to accept. For it would certainly have corresponded to a sense of their puniness before the immensity of Babylon the Great. But the exiles from Judah did not accept it. They clung instead to the conviction that it was their own God who had brought humanity into being, per Genesis. Man and woman, in the various stories told by the exiles, were endowed with a uniquely privileged status. They alone had been shaped in God's image. They alone had been granted mastery over every living creature. They alone, after 5 days of divine labour, had been created on the 6th day. The corollary of this was, of course, very clear, that the cult of Marduk ranked as the merest superstition. So too did the pantheons worshipped by other peoples, the Canaanites, the Egyptians, the Assyrians, male gods and female gods, warrior gods and craftsman gods, storm gods and fertility gods. They were all of them, in the words of the prophet Isaiah, less than nothing. In the Middle Ages, no civilization in Eurasia was as congruent with a single dominant set of beliefs as was the Latin West with Christianity. Elsewhere, whether in the lands of Islam or in India or in China, there were various understandings of the divine and numerous institutions which served to define them. But in Europe, there was only the odd community of Jews to disrupt the otherwise total monopoly of the Church. Just as humanists do today, it cast its values and ideals as universal, Catholic. From dawn to dusk, from midsummer to the depths of winter, from the hour of their birth to the very last drawing of their breath, the men and women of medieval Europe absorbed its assumptions into their bones. Even when, in the 16th century, Christendom began to fragment and new forms of Christianity to emerge, the conviction of Europeans that their faith was universal remained. It inspired them in their exploration of continents, undreamed of by their forefathers, and in their attempts to convert the inhabitants they found there. Today, at a time of seismic geopolitical realignment, our values are proving to be not nearly as universal as most of us in the West had assumed them to be. The need to recognize just how culturally contingent they are, and not to confuse them with human nature, is perhaps more pressing than it has ever been. To live in a Western country is to live in a society that for centuries, and in many cases millennia, have been utterly transformed by Christian concepts and assumptions. So profound has been the impact of Christianity on the development of Western civilization that it has come to be hidden from view. So it is, for instance, that the Amsterdam Declaration can airily dismiss the dogmas of religion, even as it simultaneously takes for granted the existence of universal legal human rights. Yet to believe in the existence of human rights requires no less a leap of faith than does a belief in, say, angels or the Trinity. The origins of the concept lie not in the application of the methods of science, so prized by the Amsterdam Declaration, but in medieval theology. When, in the 12th century, Christian scholars sought to fashion a properly Christian legal system, they naturally turned to the Bible for guidance. There they read that all men and women were endowed with an inherent dignity. All souls were equal in the eyes of God. Yet how, that being so, were Christians to square the rampant inequality between rich and poor with the insistence of numerous church fathers that the use of all things should be common to all? The problem was one that, for decades, demanded the attention of the most distinguished scholars in the Latin West. The solution, arrived at by 1200, was one fertile with implications for the future. A starving pauper who stole from a rich man did so, according to those learned in the Church's canons, iura naturali, in accordance with natural law. As such, they argued, he could not be reckoned guilty of a crime. He was merely taking what was properly owed to him. Any bishop confronted by such a case, so canon lawyers decreed, had a duty to ensure that the wealthy pay their due of alms. Charity, no longer voluntary, was being rendered something novel, a legal obligation. That the rich had a duty to give to the poor was, of course, a principle as old as Christianity itself. What no one had thought to argue before, however, was a matching principle, that the poor had an entitlement to the necessities of life. It was, in a formulation increasingly deployed by lawyers in medieval Christendom, their eis, their right. Yet this doctrine, despite its origins in Christian jurisprudence, was one that would come, in time, to slip the moorings of doctrinal Christianity. Indeed, first in the American Revolution and then in the French, the claim would be made that human rights owed nothing at all to the distinctive history of Latin Christendom. They were instead eternal and universal. The Declaration of Rights, proclaimed anti-clerical French revolutionaries, is the constitution of all peoples, all other laws being variable by nature and subordinated to this one. A momentous discovery had been made that the surest way to promote Christian teachings as universal was to portray them as deriving from anything other than Christianity. The West, over the duration of this global hegemony, would prove itself brilliantly adept at exploiting this realization. Repeatedly, Christian concepts were repackaged for non-Christian audiences. Today, as in the 18th century, a doctrine such as that of human rights is far likelier to be signed up to if its origins among the canon lawyers of medieval Europe is kept scrupulously concealed. The emphasis placed by United Nations agencies on the antiquity and broad acceptance of the conception of the rights of man was a necessary precondition for their claim to a global rather than a merely Western jurisdiction. Yet this in turn veiled a further irony. For what was the contempt displayed by the iconoclasts of the French Revolution for Christianity, if not a sign of Christianity's influence? "The old has gone, the new has come," so Paul in his second letter to the Corinthians had proclaimed. Change, in the opinion of the Romans, was by definition sinister. The phrase res noi, new things, served as a synonym for everything in society that was most menacing. Christianity, on the other hand, glorified revolution. Just as Isaiah had condemned the gods of the Egyptians and the Babylonians as mere idols, fit to be toppled into the mire, so had Christians, in the early Middle Ages, equated progress with the banishment of superstition. Trees, sacred to pagan gods, were exultantly felled by missionaries, and churches planted where blood-stained altars had originally stood. Humanists, when they celebrate the liberation from dogma and superstition that it is to be gained, in their opinion, from the application of the methods of science, are bearing witness to the enduring hold on Western civilization, not of Greek philosophy, but of biblical prophecy. It was certainly no accident that many of Darwin's most enthusiastic defenders should have borne the unmistakable stamp of radical Protestantism. Few see it, but I believe we are on the eve of a new Reformation. And if I have a wish to live 30 years, it is that I may see the foot of science on the necks of her enemies. So wrote Thomas Henry Huxley, an anatomist and biologist, whose genius for savaging bishops led him to being described as Darwin's bulldog. That it was his duty to bring light to the world was Huxley's devoutest conviction. His sense of himself as a member of an elect had, as contemporaries were quick to note, a familiar quality. He has the moral earnestness, the volitional energy, the absolute confidence in his own convictions, the desire and determination to impress them upon all mankind, which are the essential marks of the Puritan character. Huxley's conviction that medieval Christendom had been nothing but bigotry and backwardness was one that ultimately descended, not from Voltaire, but from Luther. Agnostics, a term coined by Huxley, have always tended to display, in their attitudes towards Christianity, a marked susceptibility towards Protestant propaganda. He is merely another illustration of the great paradox of our age, that Christianity has no need of actual Christians for its assumptions still to flourish. It is hardly surprising, of course, in a society that has increasingly abandoned the institutional practice of Christianity, yet still clings to its assumptions, its values, its myths, that we should shrink from staring the implications of our current predicament fully in the face. When one gives up the Christian faith, one pulls the right to Christian morality out from under one's feet. Such was the warning given almost a century and a half ago by Friedrich Nietzsche, the most radical because the most unsparingly honest of modern atheists. He gazed unblinkingly at what the murder of its God might mean for a civilization. Humanism, despised by Nietzsche as an ideology to which the English were peculiarly prone, was dismissed by him as palpable idiocy. When the English actually believe that they know intuitively what is good and evil, when they therefore suppose that they no longer require Christianity as the guarantee of morality, we merely witness the effects of the dominion of the Christian value judgment. For the English, Nietzsche concluded witheringly, morality is not yet a problem. It was not from reason that the doctrine of human dignity derived, but rather from the very faith which humanists believed themselves, in their conceit, to have banished. Proclamations of rights were nothing but flotsam and jetsam, left behind by the retreating tide of Christianity, bleached and stranded relics. God was dead, but in the great cave that once had been Christendom, his shadow still fell. The myths of Christianity would long endure, and yet there were no less myths for all that, because they now wore the show of the secular. Such phantoms as the dignity of man, the dignity of labour, these were Christian through and through. Nietzsche did not mean this as a compliment. It was not just as frauds that he despised those who clung to Christian morality, even as their knives were dripping with the blood of God. He loathed them as well for believing in it. Concern for the lowly and the suffering, far from serving the cause of justice, was a form of poison. Christianity, by taking the side of everything ill-constituted and weak and feeble, had made all of humanity sick. Nietzsche lamented what Christians had done to classical civilization. He admired the Greeks, not despite, but because of their cruelty. Indeed, so scornful was he of any notion of ancient Greece as a land of sunny rationalism that large numbers of students, by the end of his tenure as professor, had been shocked into abandoning his classes. In the days before mankind grew ashamed of its cruelty, he wrote, before pessimists existed, life on earth was more cheerful than it is now. And yet Nietzsche, a man who had renounced his citizenship, despised nationalism, and praised the Jews as the most remarkable people in history, had warned what confusions were bound to follow from the death of God. When you gaze long into an abyss, the abyss also gazes into you. Good and evil would become merely relative. Moral codes would drift unanchored. Deeds of massive and terrible violence would be perpetrated. After a terrible earthquake, a tremendous reflection, with new questions. Half a century after Nietzsche wrote this, and almost two decades after the outbreak of the Great War, the Nazis came to power in Germany. Hitler, who in 1928 had loudly proclaimed how Christian his movement was, had come increasingly to share in Nietzsche's contempt for Christianity. Its morality, its concern for the weak, the Führer viewed as cowardly and shameful. Christian teachings had resulted in any number of grotesque excrescences. Alcoholics, breeding promiscuously while upstanding national comrades, struggled to put food on the table for their families. Mental patients enjoying clean sheets while healthy children were obliged to sleep three or four to a bed. Cripples having money and attention lavished on them that should properly be devoted to the fit. Idiocies such as these were precisely what National Socialism existed to terminate. The churches had had their day. This, in the opinion of devout Nazis, was a conviction bred not of fantasy or faith, but of the proper understanding of science. The strong, as Darwin had conclusively demonstrated, had both a duty and an obligation to eliminate the weak. There is nothing particular about man. He is but a part of this world. These words, with which I opened, were spoken by Heinrich Hilmer. Here, in his conviction that Homo sapiens had no claim to a special status, and that it was conceit for humans to imagine themselves somehow superior to the rest of creation, was all the sanction he needed for genocide. He, at any rate, had understood what license was opened up by the abandonment of Christianity. Perhaps it is this that lies behind our readiness to accuse those with whom we disagree of being fascists or Nazis or Hitler. The dread of what might happen should such words cease to be taken as insults. Certainly the humanist assumption that atheism and liberalism go together is plainly just that, an assumption. It is not truth that science offers moralists, but a mirror. Racists identify it with racist values, liberals with liberal values. The primary dogma of humanism, that morality is an intrinsic part of human nature based on understanding and a concern for others, finds no more corroboration in science than did the dogma of the Nazis, that anyone not fit for life should be exterminated. The wellspring of humanist values lie not in reason, not in evidence-based thinking, but in history. The history of Christianity.
You are listening to Unheard, where Tom Holland writes, "Humanism is heresy." This article was published on the 26th of November, 2022, and was read by Martin Buchanan for NOAA.